Welcome to viewers here and around the world. I'm Christiane Amanpour, and at the top of the news this week, a journey of war and peace. My exclusive interview with the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
When you're sitting in the hot seat of decision-making, you've got to decide.
A decade in the hot seat on the issues of our time, relationships and decisions that shaped history. The war in Iraq.
You could have waited. You could have contained him.
And today's threats.
Come on, look, supposing Iran gets a nuclear weapon.
You see a military possibility against Iran.
His reflections on power and the challenge of leadership.
How did you get over it, that fear?
And on second thoughts.
I am blush now.
A This Week exclusive. Then.
It's time to turn the page.
President Obama declares an end to the combat mission in Iraq, turns to Middle East peace, and struggles to find a voice on the economy.
Can you guys still hear us?
Analysis from our roundtable with George Will, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, and Mary Jordan, former London bureau chief and editor at the Washington Post.
From all across our world to the heart of our nation's capital, ABC This Week with Christiane Amanpour starts now.
Today marks a new beginning for This Week. Through our partnership with the BBC, we're delighted that as of now, this program is being broadcast globally in more than 200 countries. And we begin with one of the most polarizing figures on the international stage, Tony Blair. This week, the former British Prime Minister released his memoir, A Journey, and we sat down for his first North American interview.
During 10 tumultuous years at the center of world events, the Iraq War is his most controversial legacy. And this weekend, anti-war protesters showed up in force in Dublin at the former Prime Minister's book signing. As well as taking his country to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, his interventions in Kosovo, Sierra Leone, and Northern Ireland brought peace. When first elected in 1997, Blair seemed a leader right for the times. His centrist policies were similar to those of President Clinton, and they forged a close relationship. And after 9/11, global events secured his relationship with President Bush.
And I give you, on behalf of our country, our solidarity.
Have you already, in your talks, found something maybe that you, some personal interest that you have in common?
Well, we both use Colgate
toothpaste. They're going to wonder how you know that, George.
But he was pilloried at home for those close ties, and in 2007, with opposition to the Iraq war hardening, Blair stepped down.
And that is that, the end.
Iraq is where we began in our wide-ranging interview.
Do you have regrets about Iraq?
You can't not have regrets about the lives lost. I mean, you'd be inhuman if you didn't regret the death of so many extraordinary, brave and committed soldiers, of civilians that have died in Iraq or die still now in Afghanistan. And of course you feel an enormous responsibility for that, not just regret. And I say in the book, the concept of responsibility for me has its present and future tense, not just its past tense.
I guess no surprises. There is zero apologizing for what happened in Iraq. You stick to your contention about the weapons of mass destruction, and if it wasn't weapons of mass destruction, then you say at least the byproduct would be getting rid of Saddam Hussein, and wouldn't the world be a better place without it? But you also talk about not comprehending the complexities that were going to be unleashed in Iraq. What precisely?
What I think we understand more clearly now is, and this is something I didn't understand fully at the time of 9/11, in a sense, at that point, you think there are 3,000 people killed in the streets of New York in a single day. And I still think it's important just to hold that thought in our mind, because I always say about this, the important thing is, if these people could have killed 30,000 or 300,000, they would have. And that really changed the calculus of risk altogether. But what I understood less clearly at that time was how deep this ideological movement is. This is actually more like the phenomenon of revolutionary communism. It's the religious or cultural equivalent of it. And its roots are deep, its tentacles are long, and its narrative about Islam stretches far further than we think, into even parts of mainstream opinion who abhor the extremism, but sort of buy some of the rhetoric that goes with it.
In your book, you wrote that this is not something to be combated on an electoral cycle. This will take a generation. Do you think everybody gets it? I mean, you see President Obama now faced with drawing down in Iraq, faced with ramping up in Afghanistan, but still putting a deadline on. What sort of message does that send as to the commitment to fight this?
I think it's perfectly sensible to set the deadline, provided it's clear that, as it were, that is to get everyone focused on getting the job done. But in general terms, I think the answer to your question is no. I think a lot of people don't understand that this is a generation-long struggle. And I think one of the things we've got to have, and one of the debates we've got to have in the West, is, you know, are we prepared for that? And are we prepared for the consequences of it?
On Afghanistan, in your book, you say, what's happening is really simple. Our enemies think they can outlast us. Our enemies aren't alone in thinking that. Our friends do too. Therefore, the ordinary folk think, I should make my peace with those who are staying, not with those who are going. I mean, I was there and I saw colonels and generals and soldiers and resources being deployed from Afghanistan to Iraq, and it had an impact.
I mean, I think that there is an issue that you know that's perfectly legitimate to talk about there.
Do you think the Americans took their eye off the ball?
Well, I think people thought the thing was on a more benign trajectory than it turned out to be. I mean,
so
that is
people were wrong.
The truth. And I think, as I say, the best way to look at this is if you analyze it by analogy or reference to revolutionary communism, you know, the fact is you wouldn't have said at any point in time when we were facing that threat, well, you're not telling us we've got to spend a few more years on this, are you? People would have said, well, we spend as long as we need to spend, I'm afraid, and that's just it.
Given the focus on Afghanistan today, wouldn't it have been better to not have diverted the billions of dollars, the amount of resources, the amount of attention to Iraq? You could have waited.
I think what I would say to that is, look, it's a difficult question to answer, but supposing we'd left Saddam.
But you could have contained him.
But
that was my
point. Yeah, I know, but you see, this is the issue, and I think it's a really important issue, this. I don't think you would have contained him.
Why not?
Because the sanctions were crumbling.
But they were crumbling before 9/11.
Exactly.
Right after 9/11, all the countries who you were trying to keep on board, people like China and Russia, the French, even sort of the left-wing Chatterati, they would much prefer sanctions and containment to invasion.
Absolutely, but if you analyse the resolutions on sanctions, and I was involved in all this, what actually happened was that they got watered down. So my point to you is very simple. If you hadn't taken out Saddam, there would still have been consequences. Now, what they are, we don't know. We can never, you know, I can say, I think he would have been a threat competing with Iran. And someone else might say to me, well, actually, he would have just been contained. We don't know. But my view was, in the circumstances after 9/11, you had to send such a strong signal out on this issue. And incidentally, don't ignore what actually did then happen. Libya gave up its WMD program. You know, Iran went actually at the time, after 2003, went back into talks. North Korea rejoined six-party talks. You know, there was a lot that happened, and I personally felt, and I still feel, incidentally, the single biggest threat we face is the prospect of these terrorist groups acquiring some form of nuclear, chemical, biological capability.
Although many would say that that is a worst-case scenario, and it is speculation because there isn't really any evidence to support that.
No, but you see, here's the problem, Christiane, it really is a problem. I don't know, and you don't know, and you're making a calculation of risk. And the thing is, when you're sitting in the hot seat of decision-making, you've got to decide. Maybe if they got them, they'd never use them. But I don't think if I was a leader today, and certainly this was a view I took as a leader then, I'd take the risk. That's the problem. That's where Iran is so difficult. You know, I had someone say to me just literally the other night, they said to me, come on, look, supposing Iran gets a nuclear weapon. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, why should they want to use it? Why would they want to cause all that destruction? Why would they, you know? It's a perfectly sensible argument, you know? And who knows, they may be right. All I know is, if I was a decision maker, I wouldn't take the risk.
So what would you do?
I would tell them they can't have it, and if necessary, they will be confronted with stronger sanctions and diplomacy, but if that fails, I'm not taking any option off the table.
So you see a military possibility against Iran?
I don't want to see it.
But you're saying it has to happen.
I don't want to see it, but I'm saying you cannot exclude it, because the primary objective has got to be to prevent them getting a nuclear weapon.
Talking the way you're talking reminds me of this passage in your book in the lead up to the Iraq war. You talk about Vice President Cheney at the time. Quote, he would have worked through the whole lot, Iraq, Syria, Iran, dealing with all their surrogates in the course of it, Hezbollah, Hamas, etc. In other words, he thought the world had to be made anew, and that after the September 11th, it had to be done by force and with urgency. So would he have gone through all that lot?
He didn't say that in those meetings, but, you know, Dick was always absolutely hard line on these things. I mean, I think he would openly avow this. His worldview was that the world had to be remade after September the 11th. But you can't dismiss that Cheney view and say, well, that's just that's stupid. It's not. It may require amendment. You may disagree with it. But
is it possible?
It's possible over time, with the right combination of hard and soft power, I think, to get to the point where nations that we regard as, or did regard as threats, become allies. But that is not always going to have a hard power solution to it.
Let me ask you about your relationship with President Bush. Many people thought that you wouldn't get on precisely because of the difference of your politics.
You know, we continue, obviously, to disagree on certain aspects of politics, like climate change or even the Middle East peace process, from time to time. And I'm a Democrat, not a Republican. But on the central question, after September the 11th, of security, we were in agreement.
You see, George W. Bush was very smart. He had an immense simplicity in how he saw the world. Right or wrong, it led to decisive leadership.
Yes, it did. And I think, you know, it's easy to mock that simplicity. And it's easy to ignore the strength that sometimes comes with that. And a decision like the surge in Iraq, you know, I can't think of many people would have had the courage to take that decision in the way that he did.
Let's move on to Bill Clinton. You describe President Clinton, Bill Clinton, as your political soulmate. Why is that?
I think he was one of the first people really to understand, to articulate how progressive politics couldn't be a rainbow coalition, that you had to stand up and be connected with people, not activists simply.
And you say he was one of the smartest political minds you ever came across.
Oh, he's phenomenally smart. I mean, I think the smartest politician I ever came across, yes, I would say Bill Clinton, yeah.
You obviously had also a lot of dealings with him at the height of the Troubles, when he was involved in the Monica Lewinsky scandal, there was the impeachment. How did you see him get through his political life at that point?
Just by the most extraordinary strength of character. I came across him in some of the worst parts of all that impeachment business, and his ability somehow to kind of refocus on the job and get it done. I remember just sitting there thinking, I could not do that. If all that was going on around me, I just couldn't do it. But he did.
Let me ask you about your sort of view of why he got himself into this situation. I was also convinced that his behavior arose in part from his inordinate interest in and curiosity about people. In respect of men, it was expressed in friendship. In respect of women, there was potentially a sexual element. His curiosity led to that?
Well, you know, I think probably what I wrote is what I wrote. I think if I try explaining it, I'll get into difficulty. I think that there are people who are part of his genius as a politician is he is extraordinarily curious about people.
You do address the issue of sex and politicians. You basically say, you know, in terms of why they take this risk.
Yeah.
You say, my theory is that it's precisely because of the supreme self-control that you have to exercise to be at the top. Politicians live with pressure, etc. So?
Yeah. So that's what you do, really. You
what,
live with pressure.
Affairs?
No, you live with pressure.
No, and then you say, you know, and your free bird instincts want to spring you from the prison of self-control. Then there's the moment of encounter, so exciting, so naughty, so lacking in self-control.
Yeah, so I'm trying to say, why is it? Because, you know, it's one of the things you know, you come across when you're a political leader, obviously, that you see people getting, you hope you never get mixed up in something like that, but you see that situation develop. People today want to know so much more about their politicians. If they do, they've got to understand they're also human beings. And you've got to be somewhat forgiving, therefore, of the human frailty, I think. That's my view.
You talk about the human frailty of alcohol as well. You say the relationship between alcohol and prime ministers is a subject for a book all of its own. What was your relationship with alcohol?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I decided to write about it in the book, thought about it, actually, because you've got to be careful writing about these things.
But no, was you need it a prop for you? Did it become a prop? You talk about a stiff whiskey or a gin and tonic before dinner, a couple of glasses of wine. Not excessively excessive. I had a limit, but I was aware that it had become a prop.
You've got to be careful of it being a problem. And at some points, it can be. Now, I was never quite sure, because sometimes, you know, it's a relaxation at the end of the day, and it's this year, for the first time, my wife had been honoring me to do this for ages. I gave it up for Lent, right? So I went for the 6 weeks without it. It's interesting.
You talk about Cherie, your wife, giving you support and soothing you. You say, on that night of 12th of May 1994, I needed that love that Cherie gave me selfishly. I devoured it to give me strength. I was an animal following my instinct, knowing that I would need every ounce of emotional power and resilience.
Yeah,
it's
I'm going to blush
racy
now.
Racy, that, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to blush now. So it's that you write these passages and they stay in, and then when you read them in the cold light of day, you think, should I really have written that in that way? But anyway.
I'm struck by so much of the tone of the book, you sort of going from kind of gung-ho, courageous bravado to really gut-wrenching fear. Because you have this amazing passage about Prime Minister's questions.
The Prime Minister knows I was given no sight of that dossier. I wasn't even contacted about it. So he can retract that for a start.
PMQs was the most nerve-wracking, discombobulating, nail-biting, bowel-moving, terror-inspiring, courage-draining experience in my prime ministerial life, without question.
It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. In fact, one of the funny things is when people in the US often say to me, you know, don't you miss prime minister's questions? And I miss prime minister. It's like asking a guy, you know, who's been on the rack for 10 years, whether he'd like a stretch. I mean, it's...
How did you get over it?
I ended up understanding it was also a physical exercise, this prime minister's question. So I used to eat differently and take a banana to give me energy before going in. And you have to confront what is the fear. And the fear in the end is being made to look completely ridiculous, which is a very human fear.
Do you still feel it at that time every week?
Absolutely. Every week at 3 minutes to 12 on a Wednesday, wherever I am in the world, there is a chill that comes upon me. It hasn't left yet.
Shortly after you became Prime Minister, you met Princess Diana. What did you think of her?
She was an extraordinary, engaging, amazing, beautiful, iconic figure.
You said that Buckingham Palace sort of saw her as a threat.
Well, they admired her, but she was such a sort of, in one sense, she was such a different type of person that for a very traditional monarchy, this was a, you know, as I say, it was a kind of meteor coming into what had been a fairly well-disciplined, well-ordered ecosystem, and that obviously had a big impact on her with big consequence.
And when she died, that created a whole nother set of realities. You called her the people's princess, and you also had to kind of get the Queen and the Buckingham Palace to understand that there was a huge wave sweeping the country.
People felt an enormous sense of loss, and so I think what was very important was for the monarchy to be able to, at that sort of supreme point of difficulty, to just pivot somewhat and come to an understanding with the people where they reached out and accepted that there was that strength of emotion.
I, for one, believe there are lessons to be drawn from her life and from the extraordinary and moving reaction to her death.
And in the end, the Queen did that, I think, magnificently, actually, and did it with a pretty flawless instinct, in fact. But it was difficult. It was difficult for me because I was a new Prime Minister. And I didn't really know the Queen.
You talk about going up to, I think, Balmoral in Scotland, have the annual royal barbecue. The Queen was actually there stacking dishes?
There is an annual event, which is the Prime Minister goes and spends a weekend with the Queen at Balmoral. The procedure there is that the cooking and the cleaning up is done by the royal family itself. So you have this slightly odd situation where you're sitting there and obviously very nervous in front of the Queen, who you've grown up with and so on, and Prince Philip's doing the cooking and the Queen's stacking the plates and doing the washing up. It's a slightly unnerving experience, actually. But it was, I mean, they do it very graciously and in a really lovely way.
Well, on that note.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony Blair, for joining us.
Thank you.
Watch more of what Tony Blair says about third way politics, the right wing press, and his difficult relationship with his successor, Gordon Brown, on our website at abcnews.com/thisweek.
No one can doubt President Bush's support for our troops or his love of country and commitment to our security.
What he should have said, I opposed the surge. I was wrong.
Some leaders who opposed, criticized, and fought tooth and nail to stop the surge strategy now proudly claim credit for the results.
If John Boehner or anybody else wants to say the surge did this, fine. Fine. The fact of the matter is, we're not there yet.
The debate on Iraq, one of the foreign policy topics we'll get to on the roundtable this morning, with George Will, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, Mary Jordan, editor and former London bureau chief of the Washington Post, and New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. Welcome to you all. And, of course, while the president did spend a lot of this last week on foreign policy, he's going to be turning to domestic policy and most notably the economy in this coming week. So let me start. He's going to have a big speech in Cleveland on Wednesday. What does he have to say, George?
Well, he has to say that things are going to get better fast, but he can't plausibly say that. In December 2007, when the recession began, at that point to now, Americans have lost about $10 trillion of net household wealth because of housing values and 401ks and all the rest. Furthermore, they had at that point, they were very highly leveraged. They had $2.6 trillion of household consumer debt. Now it's only down to 2.4, which means they're still slowly shedding debt. Furthermore, only 25% of Americans tell people that they think their income will be better next year than this year. All of these add up to the reasons why they're not spending and why, therefore, corporations are sitting on a sum of money twice as large as the stimulus.
Before I get to... Go ahead, Paul.
No, I mean, this has the feeling of a nightmare, something that you saw coming. Back in January 2009, when Obama was first announcing his plans, a number of us said, you know, this is not commensurate with the scale of the crisis. It is, in fact, as bad as George said. And what's going to happen is that this is going to bring some improvement, but then it's going to fade out in the middle of 2010. And instead of saying, well, we need more, the public is going to say, well, that didn't work. And so you're going to lose all of your ability to move forward. They haven't helped by pretending up until just about a month ago that it was all working, that it was all on track. And so he's in a very difficult position. He really needs to somehow stake out a position saying, look, there are things we can do. Those other guys, the other party, are standing in the way of it. I don't have any faith he's going to do that.
I think they did oversell their position about how quickly things would get better. So he's got to go in there and say, look, we're on a path, and we are going to get better. And remember, folks, that 1982, when Reagan just started out, it was exactly the same point. He was 2 years into his term. The employment was well over 10%, and it did come out of it. So, I mean, this was a big crisis, and it's going to take time.
Clearly, you know, Christian, there are these immediate issues of stimulus, tax cut. What do we do to get more people working? But there's also some huge structural ones. We are at a moment, it seems to me, of two inflection points. One where globalization has never been more intense, walls coming down, economies integrated. And at the same time, technology rapidly churning old jobs and creating new jobs at the same time faster than ever. So you're at a moment where you need more education than ever to get those good jobs, and more people around the world can compete for those good jobs. And certainly what Paul and George say, we need more stimulus, whatever mechanism we do, but we have a structural problem here that I think the president's also going to have to address and face.
Can I say, we are falling into the trap. Mm. Whenever you have a severe recession, people start saying, well, this is structural, it's going to be a long time, you can't cure it. What we need is more demand. Mm. I've been looking at polling, other things from 1938. This actually kind of resembles 1938 when FDR cut back too soon and the economy went back to recession. People were deeply pessimistic. They said it's never going to recover. It's going to last for a decade or more. That, you know, just more demand won't do it. Budget deficits are, we need to cut that budget deficit. Then we were, in a way, very fortunate. The war came along and took off all the restraints, and we had a recovery, and it was not structural. We just didn't have enough demand.
Let me ask you sort of the atmospherics, which actually possibly go to the heart of the matter as well. You talked about what was going on during Ronald Reagan's time at a similar point in his presidency. But at that time, and people are writing about now, they point to Ronald Reagan using his presence, boosting the optimism of the American people, talking about American exceptionalism and getting the economy back. Is there a sort of a disconnect between what the president has done and how he's sort of affecting the mood of the people?
I don't think this is a communication problem. Parties in power that start having trouble, they say, nothing's wrong with our message. We just need to be more articulate about it. I think the country has decided about this president that they were betrayed, maybe too strong, but somehow deceived. They didn't think they voted for this, and that's why they have, in a sense, tuned out. Combined with his strategy of communication, which is to have no strategy at all. Strategy means you do some things and not other things. You have priorities. He is in the country's face all the time talking, and people...
But I disagree. I think people don't know what this is yet from this presidency.
That's
the uncertainty, and that's why there's no demand. People are not spending, and that's why people... businesses don't want to hire. It's the uncertainty.
By the way, I totally disagree with all of that. Businesses are not hiring because there's no demand. There's no demand because consumers took an enormous hit. This is not a problem that's a problem of lack of confidence. This is a problem of fundamentally things are bad. There's too much debt. You need to give the economy a boost so that people can get out of that. But what is true on all of this is that Obama has had no vision. He has not articulated a philosophy. What is Obama's philosophy of government? He wobbles between sounding kind of like a liberal, then he says, well, the conservatives have some points too. He concedes the message. There's never been anything like what Reagan did, which is to say, we've been on the wrong track. We're going to follow a very different track. That's going to change things. You need to, you know, support us in this.
Can I just ask you, because some commentators, some articles were writing about the figures this week, the unemployment figures, which were slightly less bad than people
right.
expected, and they say that the word of the week should be a reassuring on that, and also that the figures show that in fact there won't be a double dip recession, which everybody was predicting last week there would be.
Except my basic reaction is, who cares? You know, if unemployment rises, who cares if we technically have a second recession? It doesn't really matter for the people. It doesn't matter for the politics even, right? So, and in a way, I'm in the camp that says that you know, less bad, things getting worse more slowly than expected, was actually a bad thing because it removed some of the urgency about doing something.
Let me put this poll up on the economy. Basically, they were asked, do you think Democrats or Republicans in Congress would do a better job of dealing with the economy? And 38% said the Democrats, 49% said the Republicans. Question is, let's say, and now people are saying they could lose the House and indeed the Senate, what would that economic plan B? What is the articulation of that?
I think one of the sad things about in polls like that for me, Christian, is that, yeah, I wouldn't mind if the Republicans were winning because they had a better idea out there. But, I mean, to me, the two ideas I hear is that the stimulus didn't work that we've done so far, the $787 billion. I think that's false. It clearly did create what Paul's talking about, some more demand, maybe insufficient. And secondly, you know, it just doesn't seem to me the Republicans have some... To say we need just tax cuts, okay, that's going to solve everything. To talk about tax cuts without talk about long-term offsetting budget cuts, what you're going to cut by way of services, not being honest about that. Well, a tax cut without offsetting budget cuts is nothing more than passing on more debt to the future. So it doesn't seem to me they're winning with a better plan.
The Republicans are deeply unserious here. They want to cut taxes. They say they're against deficits. They have no plan for offsetting spending cuts. They have no plan to make this work, and certainly no plan to get the economy moving again. They're just not serious.
Well, they would disagree. They would say that they have a serious plan, that people like Paul Ryan and others, I know you're down
yes,
on Paul Ryan.
Indeed.
But not all of the people who disagree with you are fools or knaves or foolish knaves. He's a serious man with a serious plan.
Well, the fact the Republicans are going to do so well, really, it's just the history. The president's party always gets shellacked in midterms. It's only twice, 1934 and 2002, that the president's party actually gained in both the House and the Senate.
But it's worse than that because the Republicans start from a historic trough right now, having just suffered two wave elections, a wave election being one in which a party loses 20 or more seats in the House.
Let's go to this generic ballot, since this is affecting politics, obviously. There's a preference among registered voters for Democratic candidate 41%, the Republican candidate 51%, and that seems to be a huge sort of gap for the first time.
It's worse than that, because as you say, that's a poll among registered voters. If they had filtered, and they know how to do this, for likely voters, they think it would have been a 14-point spread. The 10-point spread is the record that Gallup has had in 40 years of polling midterms.
You know, because Walter Shapiro had a column the other day, which I think made a good point. Look, I'm for more health care. I'm glad we've extended it to more Americans. But the fact is, there is a real, I think, argument for the case that Obama completely overread his mandate when he came in. He was elected to get rid of one man's job, George Bush, and get the rest of us jobs. I think that was the core thing. And by starting with health care and not making his first year the year of innovation, expanding economy and expanding jobs, you know, I think looking back, that was a political mistake.
So what does he have to do? What does he have to do now to be a one-term president?
He needs now to say it's the other guys who are blocking action. He needs to lay out a philosophy. I'm not sure if there's any way he can save the House, but if he can do it not by actually changing the economy in the few weeks remaining, but by making this an issue. Do you really want these guys' economic plan? And then he needs to campaign for it. The first thing he did was the stimulus, was not health care. He did, but the fatal thing was, A, it was too small, and B, they kept on claiming that it was just right until about a month ago. They were claiming it was just right, nothing more needed to be done.
So let me go to something quite extraordinary. On the Politico blog, The Playbook by Mike Allen, he actually singles out not even a column that's out now, but one that's coming out in a couple of days in the Washington Post by Richard Cohen, who talks about President Obama in terms of the incredible shrinking presidency. And you remember that, you know, in the 90s, there was that famous Time magazine cover about Bill Clinton about the same time in terms of midterm elections. He said, the folks who ran a very smart presidential campaign in 08 have left the defining of the Obama presidency to people on the edge of insanity. But then he goes on to talk about his Oval Office address this week about Iraq, about turning to Afghanistan and the economy. And he says, it was only his second Oval Office address, and so great importance was attached to it. He should have had something momentous to say. Is that fair?
I think it is fair. You know, one of the criticisms, certainly I've had, and many others have had, this is not, I think, original. There's been no narrative to this administration. To me, I think Barack Obama was elected for one thing, which I'm not sure he ever fully understood, to do nation building at home, to do nation building in America. That, to me, was a central tentpole. Mm-hmm. Under that was healthcare, jobs, you know, economy, innovation, education, energy, okay? He's never tied it together, it seems to me, under one single narrative. And then, therefore, he's fought each issue against a different constituency. There's never been a unifying message. I've worked here since 1989. I personally, just as a reporter or columnist in Washington, have never seen a worse communicating administration, just at the basic technical level of, hey, we've got a good plan. Maybe someone out there would be interested in writing about it I've been to Washington.
Let me ask you about your area of investigation, which is a lot of foreign policy, particularly the Middle East peace process. They did have something to show today, or rather this week, and I'm going to put up some of what the principal said when President Obama convened the leaders of Israel and the Palestinian Authority.
I see in you a partner for peace. Together we can lead our people to a historic future that can put an end to claims and to conflict.
We call on the Israeli government to move forward with its commitment to end all settlement activities and completely lift the embargo over the Gaza Strip and end all form of incitement.
So, Tom Friedman, is this real hope? Is something different this time than all the previous times?
Wow. I've been around this track so many times. Here's what strikes me about this moment. If you look at the commentary about it, everyone's basically saying that. Been there, done that, not possible. And my attitude is, you know what, let's let this story breathe. I think there's some new things here that just I make no predictions whatsoever.
But the president's involvement at such an early stage of his presidency is different than the previous president.
Yeah, I don't think that's the decisive thing, though. I think there's the things that are important. I think Netanyahu is more serious. That's what he strikes me. He's come out for a two-state solution. He did do a moratorium freeze on settlements. We don't know if it's going to continue.
Don't you think that's the key indicator in 3 weeks from now when that moratorium is maybe lifted?
And we'll see if they can finesse that, you know, some way or another. Second, you have a rebuilt Palestinian security force in the West Bank that the Israeli army will tell you these guys are serious. Third, you know, we had an incident right in the middle of these peace talks. Four settlers in the West Bank murdered one pregnant woman, okay? Mm-hmm. Normally, that would have blown up everything. Everyone would have walked away. Didn't this time. So you have an Arab world that's obsessed with Iran, okay? And so you have a natural Sunni-Israel alliance building. So all I'm saying is, let it breathe. Don't be smarter than the story. I make no predictions, but you could be surprised.
Don't you think that their number one enemy now or their number one concern is Iran, and they would be happy to make peace with Palestine more than they have in the future just so they can focus on Iran?
Well, I'm sure happy. You know, the structural problem we have now is both Israelis and Palestinians are going to have a civil war to get this thing over the... You know,
literally?
Well, something close to it. You have 300,000 settlers in the West Bank. If a deal to swap land and whatnot makes 80% of those settlers part of Israel, you're still dealing with 60,000 people. Remember, it took Israel 55,000 soldiers to evacuate 8,100 Jews from Gaza, which was not part of the land of Israel. Ditto the Palestinians. Hamas now has its own state, okay? And they're going to fight this tooth and nail. So, but I'm just saying, let it breathe. You know, I think Netanyahu's in an interesting place. I think the Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, is, the Arab world is. I'm going to sit back and pop popcorn, put up my feet, watch this, hope for the best. Make no predictions.
Well, and Hillary Clinton's, in rather an extraordinary joint interview with both Palestinian and Israeli journalists, said that this would be the last chance for a very, very long time. But also, let's go back to President Obama's Oval Office address, in where he talked about the end of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Let's listen to that. Well, we were just looking for that, where he's basically said that he's announcing the end of the Iraqi combat mission in the U.S. combat mission in Iraq. People are concerned that there's still not a government there, that there's potential vacuum being created. What do you think the legacy of that will be?
Well, the basic rule for presidents and for everyone else is don't speak unless you can improve the silence. And I don't think he improved the silence with this, because what he said was, well, we're done with Iraq. The problem is Iraq can't, 5 minutes, 5 months on, doesn't have a government. Now, we went through this when our party system emerged, first with the 1880 election, took us 36 votes in the House of Representatives to pick Jefferson as president over Aaron Burr. So new nations have these problems, but this is a nation without Madison, Jefferson, Marshall, Hamilton, Washington, people like that.
We brought up Iran in the discussion, and also Tony Blair brought up Iran and its nuclear program. Basically, I thought, with quite a hard line on what it would take to confront and prevent Iran from the worst-case scenario. People seem to me, both the White House and elsewhere, sort of peddling back on any kind of military solution to what's happening in Iran. Do you think that
Christian, there's a very interesting debate that happened in Iran this week, where Ahmadinejad, the president, there was an Al-Quds Day, an annual celebration about Jerusalem and solidarity and whatnot, and there was a whole movement inside Iran said, knock off the Al-Quds stuff. Let's talk about our country. What's broken here? Stop trying to distract the Iranian people. This was inside Iran. This was loud. These were his opponents. I believe Iran is a regime like the Soviet Union. Totalitarian regimes like this are totalitarian. They break from the top. And I don't know when or how, but this one's not going to be broken from the outside. If it breaks, it'll break from the top.
This is not 2003. People in this country, people are the public no longer believes that drop a few bombs, shock and awe, and we can remake the world in our image. So I think people are just not willing to see this.
I think a race is on. I believe that you cannot have totalitarianism as classically understood autarky imposed on the mind of a country. In an age of cell phones, the internet, satellite dishes, and all the rest. So regime change, I think, is coming to Iran. The question is, there's a clock ticking, and the Israelis are not going to wait. on regime change to save them from a nuclear weapon if it takes 5 years?
Well, the administration seems to think that its peace efforts towards, you know, to get the Israelis and the Palestinians together are actually being more accepted and more welcomed by Israel because of the way it's dealing with Iran. What are you getting from the Israeli side on that?
Well, I think they're prepared to cut the administration some slack and move as far as they can in this way on the assumption that, A, the sanctions, which are more severe than they had thought they would get, are going to work, and if not, that they would have a partner in attacking Iran. But they will attack Iran if that is the option.
But I do think that it's not just in the White House and in America, but around the world, that they know America's very war-weary. You know, a million servicemen and women have served now, Americans, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and people are really tired. There is fatigue of war. So even though they're saying, you know, all options are on the table in Iran, everybody kind of knows that it's the last
and
option.
For years, you were bureau chief in London. You've traveled all over the world, sitting in Europe, Japan, India, all the places where you've been. What do you think people are looking at the potential of another U.S.?
I think that they're a little disappointed in Obama. Remember when he was elected that there were spontaneous parties in Africa and Europe and in Asia? They couldn't believe they were so excited about America's ability to turn from George W. Bush to Barack Hussein Obama, and they were jumping up and down. They thought he would be an intellectual, somebody that would grab foreign policy, and they feel neglected.
You wrote a column, and yours has come out today, super broke, super frugal, super power, bringing this whole economy back to the issue of foreign policy. And you said you think the world had too much American power. We'll see what it's going to be without it, because it's coming to a geopolitical theater near you. What do you mean?
The column, Christian, was about a book Professor Michael Mandelbaum's written called The Frugal Superpower, and it basically argues that for all the economic reasons we're talking about, that foreign policy is a lagging indicator, basically foreign and defense policy. That is, the economy keeps remaining weak, eventually that will reflect in our ability to project power around the world. Now, when Great Britain receded as a superpower, the provider of global public goods and global governance, we, the United States, were there to pick up all the pieces and all the power. There is no one behind us, not a China, not a Russia, not an EU. And so it's going to make for probably a more dangerous and destable world.
And if America pulls back, do you think it's going to pull back
from interventions? I don't know how, but one thing for sure is that we have to decide what is desirable and what is vital. And on Afghanistan, maybe desirable, but is it really vital?
What does that say to the American people who like their exceptionalism and like their optimism and being part of leading the world?
But exceptionalism and optimism has never historically been tied really with remaking the world, particularly in places like Afghanistan. The second in command in Afghanistan, General Rodriguez, asked this week, when the December reevaluation of Afghan policy comes up, will you be able to mark significant progress? He said progress, but he flinched from the word significant. Mm-hmm. Mr. Gates, Secretary Gates, says the American people have to know that we will not be fighting here in 15 years, not 15 months, 15 years. That's not good enough.
Thank you all so much. And the roundtable continues in the green room at abcnews.com/thisweek, where you can find our fact checks in conjunction with PolitiFact and our reporters' notebook stories from around the world from our ABC correspondents.